Johnny said he was sorry about that, about not being able to occupy Sam's body along with Sam. He was sorry he could not push Sam clear out of the body and take it himself. There was no hint of remorse or understanding of ethics. I asked again if he could see any light. He could see a tiny speck, like it's a billion miles away. You pushed it there, Johnny. He would not come out of Sam by himself, so I asked the spiritual helpers to pull him out. Sam saw the helpers dragging him out, but added, "The pressure is too great, I have an awful headache." After a few minutes of easing Sam with suggestions of comfort, I spoke again to Johnny, who said he could see a larger light. He said he could see the spiritual helpers with blonde hair, blue eyes, smiling, friendly. I suggested that they might also have a very firm look, as if they might look stern if he didn't behave well, but emphasized that they did want to help him. I committed him to the helpers to take to the right place for you and told him goodbye. "They are pulling him," said Sam. "He has much to learn. I am glad he is out of you," I remarked. "Me, too," laughed Sam. "He is the one who made me lie and get confused and say things that made me sound silly." To myself, I wondered if Sam doth protest too much. I wondered what Sam himself was like, what in him was similar enough to these entities to attract them to him. Because Sam lived in another city, we had only one more session, during which I discovered that Johnny had returned. He was a mocking dark one, pleased with having fooled us. Although with the assistance of the bright beings we did get him out of Sam again, I did not get to check up on how Sam got along afterward, except that there did not appear to be any great change. It made me wonder if indeed other dark entities had moved into him, now that this first bunch had been expelled. This does occur when the client does not continue to keep the aura clear and bright by daily prayers or meditations. A biblical reference speaks of expelling a group of unwanted entities and leaving the human soul like a house newly cleaned and garnished, which may be found and occupied by other dark entities worse than the first ones if the owner of the house does not take care to prevent this. Entities who have to be pulled or dragged out are being evacuated against their will, and they do have free will to stay out or to try to return. Even their mirror room does not always keep them contained, we have found. As Master Ching has reminded us numerous times, there is no such thing as make, in the sense of, we'll make the dark ones leave him alone, or, we'll make her invulnerable. The person or discarnate still has free will, with the responsibility of making their own choices. The living person has to be consciously and emphatically desirous of having the invading entity leave, and the invader has to be willing to leave, even though perhaps after much persuasion, the time spent in the process of persuading such an invader to leave is very well spent. However, caution and common sense for would-be exorcists. I speak now to those few readers who may become over-enthusiastic about expelling dark beings from persons suspected of harboring such. An attitude of caution is far more becoming than one of arrogant assumption of your power. An attitude of true humility is far better than overconfidence. Even if you are already a therapist, you still need to learn about dealing with dark entities specifically before you are qualified to strike out on your own and face these dark beings. Baldwin's book and his workshops are a good start. The strong darks are tricksters. One of my co-workers, Lola, was persuaded by the mother of a young girl to attempt to expel the dark energy in the girl. Lola refused repeatedly, referring the mother and the girl to me, but I was a stranger to the mother, and she, knowing Lola, insisted that Lola hypnotize her daughter and do the releasement. The releasement was successful, but Lola felt ill at ease and phoned me at once, saying that she had made the mother promise to bring the girl to me in addition. 295. The entity told me to send him into the outer darkness. He said that was what I wanted anyway. So I did, she told me on the phone. I froze. She had said yes to a dark one. The trio of them came to my office, and while the girl lay quietly in hypnosis and I was sending on a harmless minor dark entity that seemed to be surprised to FMD itself in her, it turned out to be a decoy. Lola suddenly shouted in a coarse voice, "You can't go. You can't go." The shout was directed to the Minor Dark One. I whirled around to see Lola's eyes staring in rage. Recalling from the ESP course what one could do, I clapped my hands loudly right by her ears and shouted, "Get out of her! Get out of her right now!" And that was successful. The entity left, and Lola's body slumped down out of the chair to the floor, unconscious. But now I could not converse with the entity. So, telling it to remain outside of Lola's body, I allowed it to use her vocal apparatus to speak. It obeyed partially, that is. It tried to take over her body again, thrashing it around on the floor as I knelt on Lola's legs and tried to control one arm, motioning the mother to come and hold down the other arm. It was in this comical position that I held the conversation with the Dark One. I reassured the mother that her daughter, still in hypnosis, was all right, in no danger, for I had asked for protection for her at the beginning of the session, forgetting to ask protection for Lola. The Dark One was quite strong, yelling out his name and taunting me, "You weak one, you weak one." "Oh, I know I'm weak, but I have strong backup in these bright beings here in this room," I replied. He began to laugh. The loud, mocking, mirthless laughter that I heard then for the first time. "You have nothing. You have nothing." 296. I was murmuring over and over, "Jess you, Jess you, Jess you," and it seemed a long time, though probably only 2 minutes or so, before I felt that we the Bright Ones, Lola, the mother, and I had the situation under control. The thought that occurred to me was sent in answer to my prayer, I feel sure. It consisted of a simple truth: you are laughing to cover up your fear, you feel your power is less than that of the bright beings, you are shouting because you feel yourself weakening, don't fight it so hard, just be easy, come out, and look at the bright beings, turn to them, and think how compassionate they are. Suddenly the entity was gone and Lola was back. She looked up at me, startled to find herself on the floor, and asked, "Louise, what are you doing to me? What happened?" The dark being had stayed close to her until now, watching for an opportunity to get revenge for her having expelled him from his young girl victim. Lola had no memory of the interval during which she was possessed. She had a sore neck, for she said that the dark being had grabbed me by the throat and just threw me away. She said she no longer wanted to channel, being frightened by this experience. And I promised never to allow her to be the channel for a dark one again, realizing that she was vulnerable. But the dark one came back one other time a week or so later, just to laugh and mock us again as Lola was channeling a lost human entity for another client. He remained only a minute or so, but I was angry that he had made me break my promise to Lola. My own anger doubtless made the Dark One feel smug. Even so, I felt that the Dark One was thinking about some new ideas about the possibility of his leaving the cold and the loneliness of the dark existence. The Dark Ones are truly like the prodigal sons of the parable. They are still in the dirt and slime of the pigsty. 297. Eventually all are to return to their original home. Some of them can be helped right now and are glad to leave the old existence. Others we FMD are not amenable to persuasion at all and only laugh. Dottie had convulsions every time after a 16-hour course in self-hypnosis. One of the young women felt that she was capable of doing what you do, and went right home and in her enthusiasm hypnotized her grown son. It is not difficult to hypnotize others. The trick is knowing the power of spoken suggestions to a person who is in the hypnotic state, and to be extremely careful of the words one speaks to a hypnotized person. But other factors may also be important. If I took a 2-week course in anthropology, does that make me qualified to teach such a course? Well, the son of this young lady, in his enthusiasm, had a hypnosis session with his girlfriend, a freshman in college, and she immediately went into a convulsion that frightened him. He had to hold her arms and restrain her. His mother phoned to tell me of this. He was really spooked, she said. So was I, but not for the same reason. I was amazed that first she, my student, and then her son, would play around so casually with what was stressed as being 5E hypnosis, for improvement. We set up a time, and the young man brought his girlfriend to me for an appointment. He explained that he would sit close, to be ready to hold her down when she would convulse. Apparently there had been more than one experiment of hypnotizing her, but I, in my turn, explained to him that he was to sit at a slight distance and not to touch her unless I signaled that he do so. Sure enough, as she went into the altered state, her body began to tense up and then to shake. The young man rose, ready, but I motioned him back, saying to what I was sure was an obsessing entity, "Don't worry, we are here to help you. Don't be afraid. Just relax, relax." And I placed my hand softly on the girl's shoulder and kept it there with a quiet pressure. Her tension began to decrease. It turned out that there were several minor dark entities in her, but the strongest entity was her grandmother, who said she had entered the girl when the child was very small, right after the grandmother's death, because she could see and hear things, just as I could, and after I went she had no one to talk to. So I went in to protect her, she was vulnerable. But then she issued invitations. Why did she do that? She admitted that her plan of protecting the girl had not worked out as she had hoped. The grandmother was perfectly willing to go to the light, but was concerned about what would happen with her granddaughter. It was not hard to persuade the minor dark beings to follow the grandmother to the light, where they would be taken to a different place from the human soul but would be cared for. After the girl returned to full consciousness, she told us the beginning of her story, that as a child of about 9 or 10, with her younger sister she prayed that demons would come and dance for us. The children were disappointed that they saw no demons dancing, but evidently this is what the grandmother meant by her issuing invitations. The demons did come, entered the girls, and danced inwardly, with emotional mood swings and so on, and when she went into an altered state they could dance physically by causing her muscles to convulse. At least this is the way, I theorized. The main point of this story is that when dark beings are encountered, releasement work is best performed by therapists who have had training in the techniques as well as self-training by meditation and dedication to the pathways of the light. The dark beings know our fears and weaknesses and use that knowledge to their own advantage. I am thinking of an example in Martin's book, Hostage to the Devil, in which a demonic entity called the priest exorcist by a name that only the priest and one other human being knew, a name that the other human being had called him at a long ago time, one which embarrassed the present day priest. Clearing up one's own guilts and fears is a good way to begin preparing to do releasement work with dark beings. And the other important thing is trust in the bright beings and their power, wisdom, guidance, and protection. If you have never been in the habit of thinking of guardian angels or guides, then when you decide to do spirit releasement therapy you should begin to include the bright beings in your mental scenery and get acquainted with some of them. At first you begin to think about them. Next you might begin to think about speaking to them, and next, actually begin to speak to them. Then in meditation, listen for them to send thoughts back to you. Ask them questions, and listen for answers. People vary in their sensitivity, so don't be discouraged if you do not hear or see any bright beings. Neither did the little girls see demons dancing. If you issue invitations, it will be the guests who are invited who will come. You will eventually begin to feel friendly toward the bright beings, whoever they are, a saint, a religious figure, or an admired human mentor who is deceased. Maybe it is God himself, either as a human figure or as source of all that is. And after friendliness, next you begin to realize that there is true friendship between you, and trust builds a firm temple of protection, confidence, and openness to 300, wisdom from that higher level. Then when you need the help of your friends, you know that it is already there and you need only ask for it. It is important to ask, and they respond to your call. So, just as the power of the bright beings is greater than any power of the dark ones, so as we end this chapter we remind you that in you, too, the light is always greater than the darkness, and you know that you are a child of the bright universe and are not alone and need not fear. Just call on the bright ones, and use common sense. Rescue work has been conducted for decades, perhaps centuries. A small group of two or more like-minded people can gather with the intention of calling out to the lost spirits and directing them to the light. The light is invoked by a prayer or a meditation. Questions are directed to the spirit or spokesperson for any group of spirits who respond. They are guided to look upward, to locate the rescue angels of light, and to lift toward the light. This can be very effective for people killed in earthquakes, floods, volcanoes, airplane crashes, or any other disaster. Distance is not a setback. Time does not exist for earthbound spirits. This rescue work is effective for present time events and for disasters of long ago. Disturbed spirits can remain in buildings or other locations on land or sea because of strong emotional ties. When such a spirit is locked into the repeating drama of the emotional and physical pain of the original event, a living human with the compassion and ability to reach out to them can help break the entrapment in the astral realm. Summer Rain, 1989. Pierre Baldwin refers to phantoms afoot by Summer Rain, 1989. Under self-protection and self-clearing, Baldwin writes, at the completion of a releasement session, the client may feel particularly vulnerable and exposed to spirit attachment, and can make the pronouncement, I take my power back from any discarnate being who wants to attach to me. This is my space and I claim dominion here and now. I refuse permission for the way. The CU and Canons does learn to deal with most of the entities that gain entrance in moments of vulnerability. There is improvement in the capacity to communicate with the entity. The client can begin the actual process of questioning, resolution and release. Clearing of others has been accomplished by POPI after they have been cleared themselves and have taken time to learn the procedures. A person can learn to perform this loving service. The work must be done with unconditional love for the other person, a desire for improved communication and interaction between the two people, and a request to the high self that the work serve the highest good of all concerned. Interference for selfish reasons or the possibility of personal gain inflicts a most undesirable karmic burden. Skipping over other therapists, whose books are listed in the bibliography, I come now to my personal methods. In a previous book, O Sane and Sacred Death, I gave a sketch of the manner in which you may assist in the rescue or releasement of a deceased person. I quote it here. In many cases, the remedy is simple. First is the brief but very important process of centering yourself, of calming your mind and quieting your feelings before you start to help the deceased one. Souls are highly sensitive to the unspoken thoughts and emotions of the living, and a false cheerfulness will not fool them. Therefore, work on yourself first, talk to your own soul about the freedom you desire for your loved one, or the stranger you have in mind, until you do feel compassion and a selfless desire to help. Then ask for wisdom, guidance, protection for yourself and the other soul, discarnate or incarnate. Second is to call the person by name or by location or other identifying circumstance and explain to their invisible to you spirit of the deceased person how its body died, and point out that now, although people consider the person dead, the person is still alive, listening to you. Speak tactfully and as gently as you would if you could see the person right there with you. The point is to convince the soul that although it is still aware and conscious, its body is now dead. It may not have realized this. Please be careful not to let your own emotions drop into your wording terms like lonely or miss you or need you. Your purpose is to lift and help, not to drag down nor hold back. Your purpose is to release and to free and lighten the soul of the deceased one. It might be wise for you to write out what you wish to say to your loved one or to the stranger, s, you want to contact, in order to be sure your words will serve to help and not hinder your ghost. The rule is simple: accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative. You may wish to suggest that the soul sweep out old pains and weakness, old fatigue, old addictions and mean habits, etc. Be gentle as you suggest such actions, but repeat the suggestions firmly if you feel it advisable. You may feel the need to repeat your words on successive days. Do not be afraid to start. The third step is to direct the attention of your clients toward the light and tell them to move toward it and to watch for a welcoming person who comes as a guide to escort them home. This third step is important, for many souls have told us that when they lost their body they didn't know where to go, or that they feared to leave the earth plane lest they go to hell. They didn't know that the light would come visibly to receive them, so they did not look for any light, and their expectation of dim uncertainty or of darkness provided exactly that for them, thoughts being the builders in the spirit world. Therefore it is important to speak of the light, its warmth, its welcome, and of the guide who will come. If you are not sure that a guide has come, then simply invite someone who cares about this person, a high, wise, spiritual being, to come and escort the soul safely into the light and home. This wording prevents any mischievous or dark entity from turning up as guide. This third step may need to be repeated a few times, especially if the deceased one still has had feelings of unworthiness or badness. The light understands all and is more than willing to forgive all with limitless love and compassion. However, the preliminary is for the soul to be willing to rid itself of its old undesirable habits and addictions. This is the soul's first move, made by its own free will. Then comes the light's instantaneous response. When talking to the soul of a relative, or a stranger, who you may feel is lost, unhappy, or otherwise in trouble after death, you might say something like this: "Sally, or Sammy, I have been thinking of you and sending thoughts for your welfare and peace. You are at the beginning of a new period now, and the old time is past. I am sorry it was so rough for you, but now you can shuck off all the old feelings of anger at your helplessness, your feelings of inferiority and loneliness, and start fresh and new. You realize, don't you, that your body is gone? If you 316, think back without feeling any fear or pain, you will see what happened, and you will know that your body is no longer of any use to you. Neither are the old habits and addictions that bothered you. Just throw them all away and be rid of them. I think of you now as clean and clear and starting fresh. I am sorry no one realized just how desperate you were. We understand more clearly now, and we send you our thoughts and our concern. Look for the light, Sally, Sammy, and let it shine away your unhappiness. I am thinking of you now as being surrounded and comforted by the gentle light." If the person you have in mind has been really a dark character, you might remind your own self of what Dr. Hazel Denning said one time: the meaner and nastier a person is, the more he is hurting. That thought may help you to help the mean, nasty persons more easily. If it is a loved one or relative you are talking to, you might say something like this: "Dear Jim, or Betty, I think of you often and I'm so glad that we knew each other as long as we did. I put your picture where I look at it and smile every time I pass by. Sometimes I put a vase of flowers up there beside it, too. I know you have gone into the light and are happy now. Don't worry about any of us, we'll work at our life lessons, just as you did, and make you proud of us. Sure, we miss you here, but we are glad that you are with grandfather and grandmother now and are free of those old problems, and we are so grateful that you were one of us this long. In my thoughts I see you strong and healthy, strolling or even running in the sunshine, or just lying in the shade of a tree and enjoying the beauty and peace all around you. Not a bad vacation after all you've been through, is it? Or are you busy doing other things? Knowing you, I bet you have found interesting things to do already. Whatever they are, dear Jim, Betty, I'm pulling for you. And I'll see you again when I come over. I love you." Resistant entities. Resistance to being called out and sent away from the obsessed person is fairly common among the invaders we have encountered, often being a simple objection: "He needs me, or I help her." The therapist's usual formula of persuasion is enough to enlighten most of these entities to the disadvantages of the obsessive relationship, not only to the client but also to the invading entity. Resistance may be a long-time habit of fearing change. A sad case comes to my mind of a group of souls found not obsessing a living person but wandering aimlessly in the earthbound condition, led hither and thither by their leader. When contacted, the leader proclaimed that they were children of the covenant, who were faithful unto death. It devolved that they were a group who had been slaughtered because of their religion in some long past year. I did not know which covenant the leader meant or which religion they followed. All were totally deaf to any voice except that of the leader, and he was totally deaf to any of my thoughts, even while answering my voice. At last, taking a chance that they were Jewish, I asked the Master Moses to come and speak to these children of the covenant. That was the word needed. Without hesitation, the leader who had rejected all my own suggestions about looking for the light and going toward it agreed, "We will follow Father Moses." And at long last the children were on their way home. Resistance had crumbled at that one name. Therapists' methods of dealing with resistance. When Dr. Carl Wickland was doing the first releasement work in America by non-shamanic means, he would spend considerable time talking and arguing with each ignorant spirit, as he called the souls who did not understand that their bodies were dead, trying to convince them of their state and get them to move on into a higher level of the spirit world. Those who remained obdurate he sometimes threatened rather mildly with a term in what he called a dungeon, a dark gloomy room. Baldwin adopted this symbolic room, suggesting that it was lined with multitudes of mirrors, a place in which the stubborn spirit would be alone with its own myriad images until it changed its attitude. Eugene Mora uses picturization to create thought forms of neutralization of negative energies or of protection for the clients. He starts with picturing the negatives as a black cloud around the client, then pictures the cloud rising, changing color, dispersing, and going back to the person who had sent the dark thought or emotion, but in the form now of love, not of negativity. Resistant negative entities he would visualize being put into a black box. Some of the intruders cause so much misery that I have little sympathy for them, Mora E. writes, the effects of organ transplants. Since the rapid increase in organ transplants, which give renewed and health to many disabled or unwell persons, some unsuspected reissues have been appearing. For example, in Science News for September 20, 1997, an article reports a case of peanut allergy transferred to the 3 5-year-old male recipient by the implanted liver of a 22-year-old man who had been allergic to peanuts. There have been other reports of various syndromes transferred from the deceased donor to the living recipient along with the anatomical structures of the donated organs. It seems that the very cells of the donor are still faithful to their original owner and need to be talked to and reprogrammed just as if they were invading entities in this new, to them, body. Yes, and we can do exactly that, speak to the cells of the organ being donated, and to the organ as a whole, explain the summation, and command them to be congenial to their new environment from now on. This is quite similar to the directive words used by therapists in programming a tumor or directing the cells and functions of any bodily system. Mentioned in the newsletter of the Association for Past Life Research and Therapies for Summer 1997 is the memoir by dancer Claire Sylvia, A Change of Heart, telling about the changes she experienced after her heart-lung transplant, which exchanged her 48-year-old organs for those of an 18-year-old boy who had been killed in a motorcycle accident. Almost her first words to the reporter who asked her what she wanted most, after surviving the surgery, were, actually, "I'm dying for a beer right now." The words surprised her own self, for she didn't even like beer, at least not until now. She also felt mortified that she had answered this sincere question with such a flippant response. There were other new and radical changes in her tastes and habits. While still in the intensive care unit, she began to feel the presence of something or someone else within her. New cravings appeared, new attitudes, for example, an uncharacteristic aggressiveness and impetuosity that she later learned mirrors those that once belonged to her donor. She also had strange dreams. In one, she is with a happy young man named Tim L., whom she kisses and inhales deeply into her. "It feels like the deepest breath I've ever taken, and I know that Tim will be with me forever." Later, as she adjusts to her new organs, which she FMDS healthier than her old ones, removed because of primary pulmonary hypertension, she begins to learn more facts about her donor, including his name, Tim L. This sketch of the case would certainly indicate that Tim L.